Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, our latest bonus episode. Tom, we have just recorded an episode with your brother, no less.
We have, yes.
About the war in Italy in 1943.
So 80th anniversary book, a wonderful book, which I read last week. I think it's his best, actually. It's very, very powerfully written. And the chronicling of horror interwoven with the geopolitical and strategic analysis is absolutely top class. So I commend it unreservedly.
And you like it, don't you? Because what's interesting to the rest is history, listeners, about the war in Italy in 1943. So the Allies landed and they were trying to fight their way up the sort of Italian peninsula, weren't they? Is that they are literally fighting in sometimes in the ruins of vanished empires.
So the landings that they make south of Sorrento, Operation Avalanche, which is the main kind of landing, they land about a mile from the Greek city of Paestum, which contains probably the three best preserved Doric Greek temples from the 6th century BC. And he has, I mean, accounts of Texas Rangers who, you know, I mean, they couldn't care less, really. And they're kind of hunkering down behind the ancient Greek city walls. And they're kind of looking around at these temples and saying, well, they're quite nice, but it's not as important as me staying alive.
Yeah, of course.
Which is an attitude I can kind of understand. But the hairs were pricking up the back of my neck. I mean, I've been there, so I know that they survived. So in that sense, I was okay. But also he has this description of the Germans seizing control of Rome after it's become evident that the Italians are basically switching sides. And a tank goes down the Via dei Fori towards the Colosseum. And an Italian partisan describes seeing the gun turret swivel and aim at the Arch of Constantine. And it's all very kind of hairy. But the thing that's a kind of constant theme throughout it is how aware of this, of course, all the classically educated officers on both sides of the fighting are. So Hitler prepares essentially for the Italians swapping sides by flooding Italy with German troops. And the German high command called this Operation Alaric after the Gothic leader who sacks Rome. So that's slightly unsettling. And there's an excellent description of General Alan Brooke. He's flying in to see Montgomery, who's further up Italy. And he asks the plane that's flying him to zoom in and fly over the site of Cannae, where Hannibal won his great victory over the army of the Romans in the Second Punic War.
Yeah.
So, you know, a bit like Patrick Liefermeur in Crete with the German general that he captures and they swap Latin tags, you know, when they meet up. I imagine that for both sides to be fighting in Italy, it would be impossible not to be thinking of all the classical echoes and indeed medieval ones. So a battle is fought along a river where a pope had led an army into battle against the Saracens. So full of echoes, full of resonance.
So Tom, the good news for listeners is that partly in response to popular demand, you will be returning to that subject of Hannibal or approaching it
well
in a sort of long durée way, won't you? Because next year you're going to tell us all about the Phoenicians and about Carthage.
Yes, so we're going to do some episodes on the founding of Carthage, its background in the Phoenician culture in what's now Lebanon, and the build-up to the First Punic War, the first great clash between Carthage and Rome, between the whale and the elephant. And that hopefully will then set us up for a second series on Hannibal and the Second Punic War. And I guess in the long run, the destruction of Carthage. Because I like this thing, Dominic, that we're doing now, which is we are kind of seeding future episodes, like with Napoleon.
Right.
We did two episodes on his youth and we're looking ahead.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, if we last this long, to do the whole life of Napoleon.
I think that'd be brilliant.
Or do the Punic Wars or do the history of England or whatever.
Tom, I think that would be brilliant. And I think that what I like about that is it's a really good link to our first question. So it's from the Emperor Charles V. And the Emperor Charles V says, hello, I'm the Emperor Charles of the House of Habsburg and I'm a Wang. My question is, why was Napoleon sent into exile rather than executed? Was it for fear of creating a martyr? Do you know the answer to this, Tom?
Well, I imagine it's because the Allies didn't want to seem, you know, they wanted to behave like gentlemen. And there was a feeling, wasn't there, in Britain that, you know, he should be treated with a certain degree of chivalry. I mean, Napoleon wrote to the Prince Regent, didn't he, asking to be allowed to buy a kind of country estate in England and lead a kind of Jane Austen lifestyle.
In 1814, he genuinely believed, I think, that the British would let him settle down as a kind of country squire in England. I think it would have been funny if they had, actually.
I mean, there is an opportunity for anyone who can write a Jane Austen pastiche.
Yeah, it would be very funny. He would just get so annoyed. People would be coming to stare at him all the time, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they would.
There'd be people in his deer park peering over the ha-ha at him and stuff like that. I mean, actually, Elba was kind of his principality. So he was given Elba kind of to rule. And the thing is, he was, of course, an anointed monarch. I mean, that's surely a key part of it. You know, they took the attitude, you don't go around executing anointed monarchs, because, of course, this was the outrage about Louis XVI. So they couldn't then do it to Napoleon, who had, of course, been anointed by the Pope in 1804. So, you know, he is the emperor.
And so was this discussed at the Congress of Vienna?
I don't know. Do you know what? We'll have to do a podcast about it, Tom.
Well, we will, won't we?
Well, we will if we get to the end. I mean, how many more would it take to get to the end of Napoleon?
Well, quite a few, but I'm looking forward to that. Really looking forward to that.
You know who we've also talked about doing? Churchill.
Yeah.
I think at some point we need to resume the story of Churchill. I mean, in an ideal world, there'd be more General Gordon, Tom, but there isn't.
Well, he's dead, I'm afraid.
That's the tragedy.
He's dead and gone.
That's the tragedy.
But we could certainly do more tales of Victorian derring do.
Yeah, we could.
I'd very much like to see the Crimean War.
Would you?
Yeah. I loved all that.
So what listeners don't know is that in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a massive planning dinner or something, planning lunch.
Down under.
And I've actually been writing a list of topics today to take with me.
Oh, God, Dominic.
But Tom, they're good ones.
You're always outsmarting me.
No.
With your preparation. I haven't written anything. Now I'm going to have to start thinking about that. I can do it on the plane.
Because I've written down things that I think we'll both enjoy. And in fact, over this very weekend, I texted you, didn't I? Informing you that I was buying books about future topics and seeking. I wasn't really seeking approval because I had actually already bought the books, but I just wanted to let you know so you couldn't say, the Borgias. We didn't talk about the Borgias.
No, well, it was very like Daley Thompson phoning up, what was the name of his German rival? Jürgen something. Can't remember what his name was.
Jürgen Hingson.
Jürgen Hingson. And they would train relentlessly. Yeah. These were great decathletes in the 80s. And they were always kind of competing for gold medals at the Olympics and European Championships and things. And on Christmas Day, Daley Thompson rang up Jürgen and said, you know, no hard feelings. You must be having a great day. I hope you're having a good time relaxing, putting your feet up. And Jürgen said, yeah, I am. Just very good to have one day off, isn't it, Daley? And Daley said, no, I've been training. I've run a 20 miles track, and now I'm off to do some weight training. Loser! And that was very much your vibe, I thought.
Oh, Tom, that is...
Ringing me up at the weekend, saying how many books you'd bought.
Well, first of all, I would never ring you up. I mean, that would be so out of character. And that definitely didn't happen. But no, because we've got all these hours on the flights.
Yeah, we have.
Haven't we? And yeah. I don't want this to go to waste. I don't intend to spend them watching Will Ferrell movies like in the old innocent days before the podcast.
Elf.
Yeah. Right. Let's have another question. I want to hear your answer. It's from Ooh, It's James. And he says, listening to young Napoleon, I'm struck by the similarity with Churchill in that both were phenomenally physically brave. Do you think to be great, in the idea of greatness, physical courage is a prerequisite? And the reason I wanted you to do this first is because the idea of greatness, the great man, it's very sort of Plutarchian idea.
I do think that, yes.
But you see, somebody who's obviously very great is Augustus, and he's not physically brave.
Well, oh, damn you, Dominic.
Oh, Tom.
Well, okay, to answer that, he is brave because he gets informed that he is Caesar's heir, and he's not even 20.
Yeah.
And his mother says, please just lie low. Don't draw attention to yourself. You are a marked man. You know, this is the most poisoned of poison chalices. And he ignores it and he goes to Rome. He plunges himself into the nest of vipers, Dominic. It's a nest of vipers. He jumps straight in.
I think we should stop doing this thing of drawing attention to cliched metaphors because there will be nothing left to say.
And so that requires incredible courage. I mean, it requires immense courage. I agree. He is not brave in the way that Caesar or Alexander is. He's not the first person over the battlements. But I think his determination to seize the opportunity that fate has delivered him, I think he would have to describe that as kind of almost insanely brave.
Yeah. He's always getting ill, isn't he, before crucial battles, stomach troubles and things. But as you say, presumably once he discovered about the inheritance, 9 people out of 10 would have thought, I'll just settle down quietly on a farm.
Absolutely.
You know, I'll just keep my head down.
I think the other thing is that throughout his life, he is an obvious potential target for assassination.
Hmm.
And yet he can't draw attention to that because if he does that, then he is behaving like a tyrant. So the constitutional settlement that he constructs requires him to behave like a civilian leader, even though he is perpetually in danger. And we know that occasionally there are times where he will go to the Senate House and wear a breastplate under his toga. There are particular moments of extreme danger.
Yeah.
But even so, he's still going. I mean, a breastplate isn't going to help him if he's surrounded by his enemies, as Caesar was in the Ides of March. So I think that you can grant Augustus courage. But I would say that Augustus doesn't serve the general public as a model of greatness in the way that Julius Caesar does, wouldn't you say?
No, of course he does.
Historians would judge him as a great political figure, but Caesar is great, well, in the Plutarchan sense, the sense of an outsized figure that Alexander would be, that Caesar would be, I guess that Napoleon would be.
Agreed. And yet the funny thing is, to take particularly a couple of those examples, Alexander and Napoleon, Alexander's empire fell apart immediately when he died. Napoleon's empire, you know, is destroyed, and he leaves France actually arguably much weaker than when the revolution began. I mean, you could argue nobody did a worse job of ruling France ultimately than Napoleon did, because it ends with France's chance of world power really completely destroyed. But they are so glamorous, and it's partly because of that thing of physical courage. Actually, I always thought about this with Cleopatra. Cleopatra is much more famous than Augustus. If you stopped people in Nuneaton and said, tell me something about Augustus Caesar, a lot of people would just look a bit baffled, I think, whereas everybody's heard of Cleopatra and the snakes. And and I think that quality of putting yourself in harm's way is part of that.
But also, she is brave enough to kill herself.
Well, Augustus, he's not a man to kill himself, is he?
No.
He would have always found some way of turning things, you know, to his advantage. He's a brilliant, brilliant politician. But in the public mind, nothing is more attractive and glamorous than doomed greatness, which Caesar has, which Alexander has because he dies young at the height of his powers. And obviously, Napoleon has it as well, because we all know he loses. Churchill's physical courage makes him very endearing, I think. Don't you? Doing ridiculous feats of jumping off bridges unnecessarily and stuff.
I mean, I have to say, I find the courage of Victorian military heroes, and it's probably a very unfashionable opinion, but I find it just simultaneously comic and properly heroic.
Yeah.
The Earl of Cardigan riding down towards the Russian guns. Lunatic behavior. Absolutely lunatic. He's a terrible man. And yet I can't help admiring the kind of sang-froid. He rides down there, he does his duty, and then he rides back.
When I was writing the Adventure in Time about the First World War, I thought about all those men who go over the top in the trenches.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They must all have been terrified. But there's also that sense of kind of slight paralysis that comes with being part of a big group and being given an order, and you feel, I don't want to do it, but I just have to do it.
Yeah.
I can't turn around now and go the wrong way.
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting, wasn't it, in the episode we just did with my brother, where he talks about the Allies, that it's understandable why the Germans fight in Italy in these awful conditions. And my brother says that the conditions are worse than anywhere else in the Second World War, worse than Burma, worse than in the war in the Pacific, because it's so exposed, it's so cold, it's so muddy, it's so brutal. The Germans fight on because if they try and desert, then they'll be shot. But that's not an option for the Allies. They have to maintain a sense of a kind of civic willingness to do it. And I guess, again, that it must be the sense of not letting down your fellows, your comrades.
Yeah.
Which I think is where there is the kind of the slight difference with the Victorian military hero, Earl Cardigan or General Gordon or whatever. It's, you know, you have to kind of do it alone in a way.
Right. Yeah.
You have to be at the head of your troops. You have to set the example.
To be the first.
You have to go into the valley of death, or you have to kind of stand there and bare your breast for the spear to strike you down.
Yeah.
And that's what I wouldn't have.
No, I wouldn't do it.
I'd be flashman. I'd run away and gibber.
Another great historian of war, Max Hastings, always says in his books that the funny thing about courage is that there is no predicting who will have it in moments of tremendous stress and who won't, but also that it's a finite resource. So somebody who will be tremendously courageous for 2.5 years, who will be the first over the top, who will defy fate, you know, as the bullets are whistling, and then suddenly they will crack and run away. You know, that you will run out of it without expecting it.
Did I tell you about my hostile environment training?
No, you didn't. Oh, is this before you went to Iraq?
Before we went to Iraq, yeah. And we had to do this training course where they put you through the mill, basically, so you're prepared for hostile situations. And we went out to what was actually the 100-acre wood, so where Winnie the Pooh and Piglet and everybody, which made it all the more kind of grim and surreal. And they had ex-Israeli Defense Force commandos as the terrorists or the whatever. And they surprise you. So we're driving along in a Jeep down a kind of lane.
Yeah.
And then suddenly there was a guy with what looked like his guts spilled out on the track in front of us.
Oh, my word. Oh, God.
And the driver said, shit, he's been hit. What are we going to do? And the other three people in the Jeep, they all clambered out and ran over to the guy.
What did you do?
And there was a kind of rifle crack and everyone kind of jumped into a ditch. And then they kind of tried to inch out to go and get him again. And another bullet shot. Meanwhile, I'd stayed in the Jeep and I then sloped off and hid behind a tree and watched the whole thing. And at the end of it, I said, well, I feel a bit bad. I kind of cheated there. And the guy said, no, you didn't cheat. You know, it's a perfectly legitimate response. And in many ways, the most sensible thing to do, because actually, you know, he was basically saying, if you see someone, you know, it could be a trap, it could be anything, don't just rush over and be a hero. So essentially, I was given a license to be a coward. And to the degree that I felt buoyed by the experience, and I didn't really feel buoyed, because it ended up with them telling us how to commit suicide if we got captured by the Islamic State. And I remember going back to London on the train kind of thinking, oh God. But I felt kind of buoyed by the license to be a coward that I had been given by an IDF commando.
Yeah, golly.
So I would never be great, man.
You never know. That's the thing. You're very public-spirited.
Man of destiny. Maybe the call from fate will come.
All right, let's have another question.
Let's have one for you. Lambert Simlercake. Which was the bigger political scandal, Thorpe or Profumo? So these are the two top post-war British political scandals. We've done an episode on Jeremy Thorpe.
Yeah.
Which involved dogs.
Dead dog.
Bunnies.
Yes.
Fruit machine salesman, all kinds of things.
Carpet salesman.
And I think one of your funniest ever episodes, Dominic. Such a brilliant episode.
Well, I mean, that's nothing to do with me. It's just the nature of the story.
No, no, it is to do with you. I remember reading out the index from your your account. Very funny. Anyway, if you haven't listened to that, do check it out. And Profumo is a great subject, which we haven't done.
And we've totally failed to do.
And which I think I talked about because I saw the swimming pool where it all took place, Clifton.
Yeah. Yeah. Profumo, for our overseas listeners, John Profumo, who is the Minister for War, it came out that he had been sleeping with this woman called Christine Keeler. And the story was that she had also been sleeping with a defense attaché, I think it is, at the Soviet embassy, called Yevgeny Ivanov.
And they'd all met at the swimming pool at Clifton, hadn't they?
The claim was they'd all met at this party, and then there had been all kinds of other shenanigans. And it sort of consumed Harold Macmillan's Conservative government in 1963. It became, more than any other scandal in modern British history, it really captured the public imagination. It became a defining image of early 1960s Britain. And as you can tell, I obviously think the Profumo scandal is much, much bigger, because the Thorpe scandal is just ludicrous. The Thorpe scandal is the stuff of a pantomime or a circus, you know, with all the animals for one thing. Top.
But also Jeremy Thorpe is the leader of the Liberals, which are never going to be in power.
Right.
Whereas Profumo is a minister in a government.
Yeah.
And it's the Cold War.
Yeah.
It's the year after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, exactly. The Profumo scandal was reported in, let's say, American newspapers. The Thorpe scandal would never have been, because, I mean, it's just absolutely ludicrous that the leader of the third party in British politics is accused of plotting to murder a dog. Well, I mean, he didn't plot to murder the dog. They shot the dog by accident. No, the Profumo scandal is the big one. I think scandals are really, really interesting, because why political scandals work and why they catch on is they become metaphors for something bigger. So with the case of the Profumo scandal, it became a metaphor for what was perceived as being the weariness, the corruption, the lack of ideas.
Seediness.
The seediness of a Conservative government after 13 years.
Yeah.
And when later on there was a big period of scandals in British political life in the 1990s, it was the same thing. Conservative ministers in sort of hideous sex scandals, wasn't it, Tom?
But it was also with that, that was because there'd been a call to get back to basics by John Major, which was interpreted as meaning back to moral basics. And so everyone in the press then felt that they had a license to dig up anything that might faintly smack of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
I mean, you get very much the sense of that in American political scandals, sex scandals.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Where, you know, a kind of tub-thumping Bible basher will denounce homosexuality, and you know that fairly soon afterwards he's going to be found behind the gas station with his trousers down.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the big sex scandal in the States was obviously
Monica Lewinsky.
Monica Lewinsky. I mean, that would be a really good subject for the rest of his history. Although all the people in it are still alive, so I don't know how that would change the way we did it. But I mean, when I look back on that scandal,
very odd.
That had a slight pantomime quality about it. Do you remember Linda Tripp, the woman who had recorded Monica Lewinsky secretly or whatever it was?
Yes.
Anyway, what's the biggest Roman? Do the Romans do scandals? Must have done.
Well, the scandals only really worked politically, I think, when there was the Republic.
Right.
Because after that, it was all, you know, behind closed doors and people would obviously gossip about it. But scandals don't topple emperors.
Yeah.
The notorious scandal in the Roman Republic is the Bona Dea affair, which is when Clodius, who is a kind of gangster posho, Tony Benn crossed with Scarface.
Right. That's an unusual. Yeah.
So he's from a very patrician family and he wants to become a plebeian so that he can then become a tribune and use his tribunician powers to attack all his enemies, famously including Cicero. But before that, he breaks into a religious ceremony held in the house of the Pontifex Maximus, the high priest, and it is the wife of the Pontifex Maximus who is convened it, and it's in honor of the Bona Dea, the good goddess, and only women are allowed to go to it. And Clodius dresses up as a woman and goes in there, and quite what happens is unknown, but it's highly politically damaging to the Pontifex Maximus, who is Julius Caesar. And Caesar's response to this is immediately to divorce his wife with the pithy phrase that Caesar's wife must be above suspicion.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So that's where that phrase comes from. And politically, it's not too damaging for Caesar because he handles it pretty well. But it does end up playing a huge part in the dynamics of the late Republic because Cicero blows Clodius's alibi out of the water. And the two men from that point on are sworn enemies. And it's Caesar in his role as consul who allows Clodius to become a plebeian and thereby become a tribune. And when Clodius ends his tribunate, he targets Cicero and Cicero is forced into exile. And essentially, Clodius ends up using his powers that he's been given by Caesar to establish a kind of paramilitary reign of terror over the streets of Rome. So that's quite a good sex scandal, I think.
Yeah, that's a very consequential one. Well, how about another quick question for you?
Okay, one last one, because we've been told very strictly by Theo that we have to finish in reasonable time because we've got to prepare, haven't we?
Theo, who hasn't even deigned to turn up, Tom.
No, it's kind of a message from whichever hotel resort he's sunning himself in.
The fleshpots of the South Coast. So, has the use of emergency dictatorial powers ever engendered beneficial outcomes? Or, Tom, have they always been a springboard to long-term totalitarianism? I know your answer to this, but I'd like to hear you say it.
Fabius Cunctator.
Yeah. It's your favourite dictator.
Yeah, my favourite dictator. So again, going back to Hannibal, after the Battle of Lake Trasimene, Fabius is appointed dictator for 6 months. This is what the Constitution of Rome provides. He is a very effective dictator. He recognises that Hannibal is far too dangerous a general for the Romans to attempt a direct confrontation. And so Fabius just shadows the Punic army and refuses to engage. Mm. And then after 6 months, having saved the Romans from any defeat, any loss of manpower, he steps down. The normal constitution revives. The two consuls raise a huge army. They march off to Cannae and suffer Rome's worst military disaster.
Yeah.
So I would nominate Fabius. But what about in modern history?
That's a very difficult one, thinking about individuals. There aren't that many examples of individuals given dictatorial powers who then surrender them. I suppose what you could argue is there are examples of governments that assume hitherto unprecedented powers, but don't end up on a slippery slope to totalitarianism. So examples would be, you know, the governments of Britain or the United States or wherever.
De Gaulle?
De Gaulle, I suppose. He's not really given dictatorial powers, but right, he's not a dictator.
He ends up in a kind of position where he could have conceivably...
Yeah. De Gaulle has an autocratic personality, it's fair to say, but he's also ultimately a democrat.
Yeah.
So I think De Gaulle likes to run things. He likes to be the boss. He didn't really like it after the Second World War when he looked like he was being dragged into kind of parliamentary politics because he's not really a parliamentary politician. But he doesn't want to be a dictator.
What about your guy in Costa Rica?
Right. Yeah. Don Pepe.
Don Pepe.
Jose Figueres. Perfect example. I'm amazed that our listeners haven't all, you know, that they need to ask the question.
They may all have been screaming it at the episode as we do it.
Yeah, no, you're right. Don Pepe is a very good example. I think there are developing world strongmen who don't necessarily end up being totalitarians. They're sort of people who are relatively autocratic. I mean, we've had lots of questions. Will we ever do episodes about Ataturk, the sort of autocratic nationalist founder of the Republic of Turkey?
He never really gives up power, does he?
He never really gives up power, but equally, it's not a springboard to totalitarianism.
No, you're right.
I mean, sure, you know, you don't necessarily want to be an opponent of the regime, but equally, you know, it's not remotely comparable with a genuinely totalitarian regime like that of Stalin or Hitler. And to go back to my point about the accumulation of power and sort of regulation of life, in the world wars, the governments of the Allied nations took on unprecedented powers, but some of them they handed back afterwards. I mean, people at the time, you know, who are very politically engaged, might well have said, oh, it's terrible. conscription, for example. They would say conscription is a slippery slope. The next thing we know, it's a bit like when people have the arguments about COVID and the powers of lockdowns. And they say, is this a slippery slope towards an Orwellian world? Well, it might be, but equally, sometimes it just isn't. You know, you have to have some degree of confidence in your political institutions and your political culture. So, yes, I think sometimes quasi-dictatorial powers in an emergency can have relatively beneficial outcomes. When Churchill took office in 1940, he said, you know, the interests of labor or of capital are as nothing now, or property. We will seize what needs to be seized. We'll do whatever needs to be done. But that didn't mean that Britain then was heading towards a kind of dictatorial state or anything like it. So I think it depends on the characters of the individuals. I mean, a much better defense is the political culture and the health of your institutions.
Very good answer, Dominic. Very good.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Just one last mention, because I want to draw listeners' attention to a new collection of ghost stories that have been written by a member of our community chat, Dominic.
Chat community.
Chat community, is that what it is?
I know you love the phrase.
I knew it had chat and community in it. I just didn't want to say it. So Peter Wise, who has written a series of ghost stories themed around fishing called Disturbing the Water. And so there's one set in the English Civil War. There's one set in the Second World War. There's one that features a Victorian serial killer, the witches, all kinds of things. And the reason that I wanted to mention that is that it was inspired by the episode we did with Roger Clark on ghosts. That must have been ages ago, 2.5 years ago. So I think that that's the first collection of short stories about ghosts and fishing that the podcast has inspired. I'm sure it won't be the last.
Yeah.
Since it's the first, let's give it a shout out.
That is a lovely shout out, Tom. So everybody should check that out. Okay, listen, Tom, we are going away on Wednesday. So our next bonus episodes will be coming to you from the South Seas, won't they?
Yeah, they will.
From the deck of the Endeavour.
We'll be having Cheshire cheese and port.
Yeah.
Like Joseph Banks.
Have you packed your pith helmet? That's the question. Right. So we are very excited about that. So for our Australian and New Zealand listeners, we will be seeing you shortly, many of you, in Auckland, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, and Adelaide. The rest of you, I'm afraid you'll just have to content yourselves with our dulcet tones. But you're in the middle of the fall of the Aztecs, most of you.
Those of you who haven't just gorged on the whole lot.
Madness. Gorged it. And then I have to say, we're then going to test your, you know, your self-discipline once more with another series.
This is seven, isn't it?
Yeah, seven-parter on JFK.
Yeah.
Kennedy, his life, his times, his assassination, and the theories surrounding the assassination. And then after that, Tom, should we give them a little preview?
We've got my brother's episode, which we were talking about.
Yes.
So that's on the Italian War in 1943.
Then Pope Joan.
Yep.
So that's a very fun one.
The female pope.
A great scandal story, actually, a Victorian scandal, the Tichborne claimant with Zadie Smith as our guest. We will be doing episodes about the history of Italian food. Tom, are you going to do something to do with Christmas?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Saturnalia, I think, specifically.
The Man in the Iron Mask, The Life of Harold Hardrada, The Night of the Long Knives, Kristallnacht.
Peasants' Revolt.
Richard II and the Peasants' Revolt, and so on and so forth.
There are lots to come.
And we will wind our way towards the Phoenicians and Carthage as promised. So lots to look forward to. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for all your support, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.